Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us through WCTCAM or RestaurantGuysRadio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis. How are you?
I'm great, thanks.
I have to talk about something that came with our press stuff in the last couple weeks.
Our solicitations for possible show topics?
Well, sure. Obviously people send us a lot of books. Francis and I, we get to read a lot of this stuff. We get to look at a lot of this stuff.
We get to throw a lot of this stuff away.
And we throw it and decide who we want to interview and who we don't want to interview.
Usually goes like this.
Every once in a while, one of the no topics is something so freaking hilarious that I have to share it with you all.
Mm-hmm.
The book that I have in front of me is called Skinny Italian. It's done by Teresa, one of the Real Housewives of New Jersey.
Oh, my God.
And it is an unbelievable... I apologize. I've never seen Real Housewives of New Jersey.
I have.
But I feel like I have some little bits and pieces of it.
I have seen it.
You have, really?
Yes.
I am currently ashamed of you.
I'm sorry. It is a train wreck, and our staff began referring to... being in New Jersey, our staff, my friends, they began to refer anyone who's really... And I got to tell you something. What I can tell you now that I've seen The Real Housewives of New Jersey, and I've lived in New Jersey, they are not exaggerated. Those people exist.
They definitely exist.
They come from Nutley, where Mark is from.
They definitely exist, and a lot of them live in Nutley, Bluefield, and Belleville.
And they're not even those people on the show
phenomenal.
Are not even like crazy extreme for what the culture of Jersey is. Okay. It's like the Jersey Shore. Same thing. Those people really exist.
Okay, on the back cover. Eat spaghetti and still fit into your skinny jeans. Okay, that's on the back cover. As I said no to this book that we were not going to get her on to interview her, I caught the back cover. I was like, wait a second, I need to look a little deeper in here. And here's what we're going to say. There are some little bits and pieces of good advice, things that we say, eat real food. Shop around the edges of the supermarket, buy organic. A lot of the things that are in here are, the fewer ingredients, the better, things like that. But one of the tips is avoid stripper food.
Okay. What do strippers eat?
Hold on.
It's been a fantasy of mine for a long time, but I've never actually dined with a stripper.
Want an easy way to remind yourself of whether food is healthy for you? Never eat food that is also a stripper's name. Cookie, candy, cupcake.
Oh, my God.
Disagree, though, because I eat Bambi. Okay, I got to argue with you there.
Oh, bunny. I eat bunny.
I eat stripper foods. Anyway.
Hold on a second.
I know that some of you are going to buy this book because of the stuff that I'm about to read to you. Go ahead.
I just want to contemplate that for a moment. Don't eat stripper food as a rule. Okay. What would Michael Pollan say?
Forget what would Jesus say. What would Michael Pollan say? Yeah. That's very funny. God. So, I need to read you a little. In the book, there are little excerpts, and I don't know who Joe is, but I think I know who Joe is.
Is Joe her husband?
I don't know. It says, but there are juicy bits from Joe. Okay, and hold on. I gotta work my way into my Nutley Italian.
Where you come from?
Before I can read this,
your people.
I can't read this until I get all the way into my character.
Yeah,
hold on.
All right.
Okay, juicy bits from Joe. Ready?
Yeah.
This one time, Teresa and I were making lasagna from scratch for company, and to hurry things up, we decided to stick the eggs in the microwave. Don't ever do that.
That's a juicy bit from Joe. Joe had to buy a new microwave.
First of all, we forgot that we had eggs in there, so they started exploding really loudly. We couldn't figure out what was going on. It sounded like gunfire or something.
They were on the floor looking for the pistols.
We were ducking. Our guests were hiding. It was crazy.
Guess why?
When we realized the eggs in the microwave, ah, Maron, what a mess we had on our hands. There was eggs, there was eggs everywhere. Maybe that's what put Teresa off from cooking our pasta from scratch. A lasagna nearly gave us a heart attack.
Oh, my God.
This is a juicy bit from Joe.
Oh, that's a juicy bit from Joe.
That is exact quote. I changed none of the words. I changed absolutely nothing.
I got to tell you, they got the picture of these two little girls who are their kids. And I don't know if they're kids or whatever. They're cute kids, really are. But they're eating spaghetti like it's
Lady in the Tramp.
Yeah. That's what I was looking for. You got it. That's what I was looking for.
You wanted a visual. So anyway, I don't encourage you to buy this book, except it's freaking hysterical. Okay? And, you know, there are recipes in here, and like I said, some little bits of good advice. But the little juicy bits from Joe are that was just one beautiful little juicy bit from Joe. And how much fun is that?
Can we please throw away that book?
Yes, we can. I'm completely done with it now. I laughed. I cried. I made macaroni.
Thank you very much. I guarantee you that every one of Mark's grandmother's recipes is better than every recipe in that book. Anyway, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTCAM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, and today our guest is Johnny Uzzini. He is the executive pastry chef at New York's Jean Georges restaurant, and he's a multi-award-winning chef. He's a holder of a James Beard Award, and his book, his wonderful and beautiful book on desserts, is called Dessert Foreplay, Sweet Quartets from a Four-Star Pastry Chef.
Hey, Johnny, glad to finally get you on the show. It's been too long.
Hey, guys, what's going on?
Well, we've read your book, and we love it. It is really, I think it's one of the most beautiful books on dessert that I've come across in a long, long time.
Thank you so much. You know, it was a lot of work to get to the point where it's at. We had to go in both directions, you know. Like, I have a very creative eye and creative touch, but we didn't want it to be too intimidating for people. So we scaled back on some of the technique, you know, to make it more approachable. We inserted a lot of boxes we called make it simpler boxes for people to take shortcuts, you know, to make it, again, more approachable. But when it came to the photography, I definitely didn't want to skimp out on that. So I have a friend who I ride motorcycles with, and he does a lot of photography for Ducati and other great machine kind of ads like that. And I just love the way he could photograph something, you know, the dimension, the color, and just the way it popped. And he had never really shot food before. So I thought it'd be great to, you know, so many times you see books with the same style of photography and, you know, same people shooting it. So I was like, I wanted something very different. So I brought my friend Gregor in, and he really, like, you could see, like, the dessert just, they jump off the page. They're so...
The book just pops.
Yeah. I think a lot of our listeners also really appreciate the fact that you're making it a little more user-friendly, because most of them don't have liquid nitrogen at the ready.
So, here's the question, though. For your book, who's the target audience? Is it professional? Or, I mean, because you could certainly make these things and serve them in a restaurant kitchen. Is it professional, or are you looking for consumers?
You know, it's funny you ask that question, you know, because that was kind of a struggle for me in the beginning, you know, when you're a young chef, you know, I would hate to say it, but I mean, I guess maybe there was a lot of ego involved on my part. And, you know, I wanted to make the book that best represented what I do every day without really thinking about the market, maybe, of what, you know, what a publisher wants. So, of course, they were looking for more middle America, mainstream. And I felt like, well, you already have all those books. Why do you need me to make that book? You know, and I was coming from it like, I want to make a book that maybe would impress my colleagues, or, you know, kind of set my style in stone. And so it was kind of like a tug of war at first, you know. But the bottom line, it really hit me, and they sat me down and like, listen, you know, publishing is a business. You know, we understand we want to make a book that you're very proud of. But at the same time, it's like, do you want to sell 5,000 books to chefs or 50,000 books to America? You know, people that actually cook at home, you know.
Well, you
so that hit a chord with me, and that made sense, you know. Like, you know, as much as it is a book and it is a mark of my creativity and my integrity, it still is something that has to be sold, you know, and that people would want to buy because they want to try the recipes.
Because they can use it.
Yeah, so what we did is we simplified wherever we could in techniques. You know, we tried to use more common ingredients and maybe harder to find ingredients, but you'll see throughout the book there are little sprinkles here and there of tech stuff, you know, to make it interesting for still the professional chef to want the book. You know, you'll see some use of hydrocolloids here and there or whatever, but there's also ways around it. You know, there's plenty of recipes that, you know, involve just fruit or salt or cream, you know, or sugar. It's very simple, you know.
You know,
so I think it's a blend of both worlds, and because everything is designed in four plays, it's, you know, the more proficient you are in the kitchen, the more you'll attempt to try at home. And, you know, there's things that can be done in advance, things at the last minute. So, you know, it's not like it could be daunting to look at all at once, but if you really break it down and read through the recipes, really, it's not that complicated, you know. It's really not. It's just maybe my style of plating makes it look more complicated than it actually is, too.
Well, you know, it's funny. I think that you released the book in a time where the home cooks who do this as a hobby, I think the people who are going to be attracted to this book, it may not be mom serving dinner, you know, five nights a week who, you know, pulls out a Wednesday night to
right.
do a Johnny Uzzini foreplay.
Right.
I think that the home cook is going to attempt this. You have a lot of home hobbyists who are really quite skilled, you know.
Yeah,
And I think this really, you know, we have a regular listener who took a friend's cookbook, Restaurant Nicholas, a guy named Nicholas Ferrari, did a cookbook. And he is cooking his way through the cookbook, you know, kind of like Julia
That's
and
funny.
Me
There's
style.
A couple of people doing that with my book as well. They email me pictures from time to time.
Right. Well, this guy has a blog up. He's doing the same thing, and it's really it's fun to watch. It's fun to watch that happen. And I also think there's enough stuff here for pastry chef, and I'll be honest with you. And I'm really curious, Johnny, because I know you travel and you know a lot about desserts throughout the country.
Uh-huh.
Outside of major cities and top restaurants, I think desserts are really a problem for a lot of places because a lot of mid-level restaurants can't afford a separate pastry chef,
sure.
Don't have a separate pastry kitchen, which you really, when you're talking about a kitchen that may get very, very hot, it makes some of the pastry things hard to do. What do you think is the state of pastry and pastry chefs in America?
You know, it's funny because Jean-Georges himself, you know, always kind of threatens me. He's like, you're a dying breed, you're a dying breed, you know, you're a dinosaur, you're going to be extinct soon. And there's definitely some truth to that, you know, like in some ways, you know, I think, like you said, for maybe some of the smaller restaurants, chefs, you know, have a need to have more knowledge in that department. But, I mean, at the higher levels, I think there's always going to be a market, like in hotels and high-end restaurants are always going to need pastry chefs. You know, you always need that department to be as strong as the rest of it. You know, and it's sad. It's sad that, you know, that desserts are thought of as an extra, you know, or an amenity or, you know, like something that could be cut. You know, I mean, I don't know. I feel it's an important part of the meal as well, you know. But, you know, there's something to be said for, you know, desserts have always been a treasure, you know, maybe a little gift at the end of the meal. And, you know, they may see it as surplus or not, you know, because not everybody orders dessert. So, you know, they come and they want to get their satisfaction from their appetizer and entree. And, you know, if people are going to cut back, they're going to cut back on maybe a nice bottle of wine. They won't order extra dessert or something like that. So, I don't know. I mean, In the end, you know, there's two things that have the least amount of overhead as well and the lowest food cost, and that's liquor and desserts. So those are the two categories that actually make you the most money in a restaurant as well. So it's kind of like a double-edged sword in a lot of ways.
Well, and it's also the final impression when you leave the restaurant.
Sure.
Johnny, you'll be very happy to know that my wife has a rule. Mm. And that rule is if she doesn't have dessert after we go out to dinner, it doesn't count.
Now, Johnny, on the top end, though, there are some things that are happening in dessert that I find really exciting. And I want to ask you about some trends that you see in dessert, and then I want to ask you specifically about some things in your book. But one of the trends that I think we're seeing among serious pastry chefs across the board is the breakdown in the barrier between savory and sweet, people using savory items in desserts. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, I mean, there's different schools of thought, though. I mean, I'm not one of those pastry chefs that love hyper sweet desserts. I'm not trained in classic Americana style, so I tend to think of food more from a French point of view and more also from a little bit of a savory point of view. Because, like, to give you an example, right now I'm working on the spring tasting, and one of the things we're working with is peas. You know, and we did a sweet pea ice cream. You know, it's going to go with bitter almond macaron, and we use a gelée from the inside of a green almond, you know, which is quite savory. You know, we did a carrot confit and all this other stuff. So, I mean, you know, when you talk about ingredients, you have to think about, you know, just because someone says this is a fruit and this is a vegetable doesn't mean, you know, come on, it's something that's fresh, you know, it's something that's grown, and some things have inherently a lot of sugar content, like a pea or a carrot can be very, very sweet. So why not incorporate that into a dessert? You know, like it's just there shouldn't be any lines between those things, and people shouldn't be freaked out if they see, you know, stuff like vegetables on desserts, you know, and like, oh, what is this? This is crazy. It's matter of why. I mean, it's just something else that's grown in the ground or on a tree. How is it any different from an apple? You know, just because someone says, you know, it's silly in a lot of ways. Now, if you're talking about like foie gras and bacon, you know, in desserts, okay, you know, that definitely has a different degree of savory to it that maybe people are turned off by. But again, you know, like, you know, someone who loves food, they'll definitely translate that into their pastries. You know, like I've used the fat from bacon before to make caramels and stuff like that, and I think it's delicious. You know, is it for everybody? No, but we don't force things down anybody's throat. We don't push people past the point where they want to be pushed. You know, we offer certain things and try to open people's mind up to new ideas and new combinations, but by no means do we say, if you don't like it, you don't have a good palate. That's silly.
There's an ingredient that you use that you use more than most pastry chefs I know, but is one that I think is truly underutilized in most of the pastry in this country, and that's salt. You're not afraid to use salt in your sweet desserts, and I think it's, like I said, it's one of those truly underutilized pastry ingredients.
You know, salt is I couldn't work without salt. You know, salt is almost as important to me as sugar is. You know, there's salt in almost every recipe we do. You don't necessarily taste salt. People are like, oh, really? You put salt? Why do you put salt? I don't like salty desserts. Well, you're not going to taste salt per se, but you would taste a difference if I took the salt out.
Right.
What salt does is it helps open up your palate. It helps you taste more flavors. You know, it opens up, you know, all the taste buds get stimulated by the salt. And they're like, if you ever tasted chocolate and then taste chocolate with just a little bit of salt on it.
Oh, love it.
It's a complete different experience.
We have a chocolate company called Restaurant Guys Chocolate, and we ship chocolate all over the world. And our most popular flavor
by far
ever is, we can't take it. We cycle through the other flavors, but the most popular flavor we can't take it off is, it's an Austrian roasted pumpkin seed chocolate with Maldon salt on the bottom of it, and people.
That sounds delicious.
Oh, it's great. People love it. So, but salt and sweet, it has a place in pastry and sweets. I agree. You know, another thing that you talk about. Well, first of all, you mentioned foie gras and bacon, and I know because I don't know if you recall, but we had dinner together down in New Orleans with Audrey Saunders and a bunch of folks at Tales of the Cocktail last year.
Yeah, of course.
And one of the things we talked about with Audrey, and I know you have a real interest in cocktails, and maybe one day we'll open a cocktail bar that you will give me a VIP pass to so that I can get in even when there's a line, where Jimmy Meehan is kind of on the front line of this over at PDT, he has cocktails that are fat-washed, bacon-washed bourbon, you know, and
right.
the like. So I think that we're crossing a lot of lines here. I think you need to be careful when you do it, or you can come up with something disgusting. But when you do it right, I mean, that's the skill of a culinarian, right, to be able to work across those lines.
There's a lot of people that are actually doing that now, doing a lot of fat-washing stuff. And it's funny you say Jimmy Ham, because I don't know if you know or not, but I actually did a barter with them where I actually worked at PDT on my day off for 3 months, every Sunday night bartending.
You know, I didn't know that.
And so Meehan and I were going back and forth, and like the idea was like I would learn, you know, how to be a bartender and learn like what the mechanics of bartending, but at the same time I would open up my knowledge to them, you know. So there was a bit going back and forth and talk, but you know, it was too busy. Jimmy was busy traveling a lot, so we didn't get to a chance to work together as often. But it was a great experience. So for 3 months, every day my day off, once a week, I would bartend at PDT for fun.
You know, just the connection there. Do you want to make the connection, Mark? The connection there, of course, PDT is a great cocktail bar in Manhattan. You've heard us interview Jim Meehan on this show, and he, of course, is an old friend of Mark and mine as well. And there we are with the small world just one more time.
So, Johnny, I need to know, okay, right here on the radio for all of us, our listeners. You're down in New Orleans at Tales of the Cocktail. You're a pastry chef. What are you doing there?
Well, same thing. Like, you know, people come into the bar and they're like, why is one of the top pastry chefs in the country behind a bar? You know, like, well, I think it's a similar medium to what I do. You know, I mean, I'm a pastry chef by trade, but it's a love of food. It's a love of flavors. It's a love of putting together combinations, you know, and that maybe you wouldn't think about together. Or maybe they are classic combinations, but maybe approaching it in a different way. My goal later on is to, you know, I have a partner that I've been working on developing a project with that we're going to apply everything I am as a pastry chef to a bar. You know, and this has been something I've been talking about for years. And it's just because I'm so busy and because I don't have the time. I just never came to fruition. Plus, you know, it's finding the right partners and everything else. You know, people always say, I have a great friend in New York who gives me a lot of great advice. He's a wonderful businessman, and he's like, you know, Johnny, money's cheap in New York, but finding the right partner is the hard part, you know? So I've always been very skeptical. I've seen so many of my friends, you know, go down the road and be so anxious to open something, take maybe a deal that they think is good, but don't protect themselves properly or don't really know their partners, and in the end lose their dream along the way, you know, and either the business closes or they're out, whatever, and I just don't want that to happen. And I've never been in a rush, you know, like I'm a pretty loyal fellow. I've been at Jean Dorge coming up on 8 years now, you know, I was with Danielle for 7. So I'm in no rush to walk away from what I have, but at some point I do want to apply everything I am as a pastry chef. So what that means is to approach cocktails, you know, so if you think about what the trend is in cocktails, is everything's like pre-Prohibition time, right? Because that was the last true mark of quality, because then Prohibition came and stripped them out. Everybody was serving moonshine and poison and everything else, and people were like going blind from some of the alcohol they were serving. It was crazy. And then after that, you know, so much of these bar manuals were lost and gone for a while, and people forgot what it was to make a quality drink, and then like box drinks came out, like sour mixes in a box and really horrible quality things. People weren't using fresh juice anymore. So thinking back, you know, the last true mark of quality was this pre-Prohibition time, like the Jerry Thomas time, like turn of the century. So, but we don't cook like that. You know, we don't cook like we did in the turn of the century for a reason. You know, we've evolved. So what we plan on doing is applying all those principles of, you know, fresh juice, you know, really high quality things. But instead of maybe doing an infusion where I'm going to take a handful of cinnamon sticks and other spices, throw it in a jar and put it on a shelf for 4 months, I'm going to put it in a bag and cryovac it and vacuum seal it, and do an instant infusion. You know, I'm not going to buy pickles from somewhere. I'm going to make my own pickles, you know, like stuff like that, like really applying a chef's point of view to a cocktail. But in the end, the idea is to create the most delicious cocktail imaginable. You know, it's not about doing things for glitz or, you know, or silliness or, you know, I don't plan on, you know, doing crazy foams that just are silly unless they taste delicious. You know, there's no point in doing something if it doesn't make the product better, you know. So I've only applied technology where technology can make something greater than it was when it started.
All right, Johnny.
So that's the idea, yeah.
Francis and I have never been high on molecular gastronomy.
Mm-hmm.
Convince us
we're
wrong.
Well, first of all, it's a horrible term.
I know it is. It's the worst. It's for people like me who want to put it down. That's what we use. Convince us we're wrong.
Okay. Well, what is molecular gastronomy to you? What does that mean to you?
To me, it's turning food upside down so the imagination can be about, you know, expanded to as far as you want to go.
Okay. Where have you experienced it? Like what meals have you had that have turned you off by?
Let me give you the example just because I remember your reaction to it. When we first had fried mayonnaise at WD-50 or at Jimmy Ann's place where they put it on one of the Kriff dogs.
It was uh-huh.
WD-50. But at PDT they also put it on one of the dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And what Mark said to me was he said, "That is very, very cool that they fried mayonnaise. I don't like it as well as regular unfried mayonnaise, but it's very cool they were able to do it. The question is, why did they do it?"
Okay. there's the approach where, for me, if you talk about molecular gastronomy, there's two schools of thought. There's A, using a product called hydrocolloids, right, which are mostly organic, mostly made from seaweeds and different plants. Okay, so people say, "Oh, they're chemicals. They're not. They're no different from agar. You know, they're no different from things that have been around for 1,000 years that they've been using in China and Asia and everywhere else. You know, so first of all, let's get away from calling things chemicals because they're ingredients. At one time, you know, if you think about it, so is baking powder and baking soda.
Right.
Those are more chemicals than the hydrocolloids. You know, and all hydrocolloids do, their main function is to control water activity and to create new textures, right, to help us change the way we deliver a flavor, you know. So if I can use a hydrocolloid instead of using maybe an egg or flour or something to thicken, if I can use a small percentage of a hydrocolloid, that means I don't have that egg dulling my flavor. I don't have the flour dulling my flavor. Now I have, say a rhubarb, right? I have a rhubarb juice and I want to make a gelée or something else. now I can use much less other ingredients to really put that first and primary flavor forward. So for me, it's amazing to have these products because they allow us to do things we couldn't do before, you know, and that's control water, could be control textures, you know. Whether it's someone's approach, like some of the best meals, like last year I ate at El Bulli for the first time. And it was 37 courses, mind-blowing. It was probably the most humbling meal I've ever had. And I went in there, you know, kind of like wanting to have a couple things go wrong and everything else, and it really didn't, you know. WD-50 is also, I think, a really wonderful and great restaurant. He's a good friend of mine, Wiley. Do I love every dish? No. Do I think sometimes it's interesting for the point of interesting? Yeah, that could be said at a lot of restaurants. But I think their goal is to make the most delicious food possible in a new and interesting way. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Otherwise, every restaurant would be the same around the country. What's the point? You know, I think it's fine that they think about food in a different way. They think about technique in a different way. They handle their things. And, you know, it's funny you say the mayonnaise. That's a great thing. It's a great point. But I'm gonna flip it on you. You know, think about macaroni and cheese, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody loves macaroni and cheese, maybe like everybody loves mayonnaise. You eat macaroni and cheese, and you know it's the first bite you eat it, second bite you eat it. It's the same texture all the way through. And what happens when you take macaroni and cheese and you put like those little frizzled onions on top, or some breadcrumbs, or something like that? Now every bite you have is a little bit different from the last, and it's going to be different from the next. Maybe it's a different proportion of macaroni and cheese to topping, or more topping to cheese, and it's interesting, and it keeps, and it's more like, it stimulates you while you're eating because the textures keep changing, and I think that's probably what Wiley's going for with that. You know, rather than just put mayonnaise on something, why not encapsulate it, give it a little texture, give it a little crunch, still have the delicious creamy warm mayonnaise on the inside. It's no different, but now you just give it a little bit of crunch, a little bit extra dimension, and I'm wholeheartedly behind that school of thinking. Why not? If you can make something better, why not try? You know, if it was just for the sake of doing it and it didn't add anything flavor wise, then I would say it's a failure. You know, we don't do things just to do them for the sake of saying, oh look, I'm the first one to put foie gras and pumpkins and, you know, horse manure in a cocktail. You know, ooh, you know, but does it taste good? All right, well I'll drink it if it tastes good, but if it doesn't, don't give it to me. You know. So I think there's a lot of ego that's involved in that style of cooking that people make the mistake of you know, jumping onto maybe jumping onto a fad without understanding how to really utilize these ingredients.
You know, in talking to Grant Achatz about that, as we talked to him about 6 months ago, we had him on the show,
mm-hmm.
and that was kind of the same conversation we had. The conversation wasn't the problem isn't the techniques, the problem isn't these new things that we're trying. The problem is that there are either
poorly executed
people pushing it too far, people doing it just for the sake of doing it instead of doing it to create something that maybe is more interesting and tastier.
I also think that when you're in the business, there's whether you're behind the bar or in the kitchen, there's a natural tendency to, when a new technology comes out, to want to use it. And so, but you have to just be careful that you need to be using that to move things forward, and when you use that technology to get a better goal, then you put that out. And sometimes if you use it just to show that you can, that's, you know, kind of problematic.
You're exactly right.
We're going to take one quick break here, and we're going to come back, and we're going to talk with Johnny about his book and about some recipes that are in his book, and maybe we'll even get his permission to put one up on the site that we can refer you to. You can find out more about Dessert Foreplay from Johnny Uzzini at our website, restaurantguysradio.com. We'll, of course, post a link. And we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC-AM and restaurantguysradio.com.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, and we're talking with Johnny Uzzini about dessert. Johnny is Jean-Georges' four-star pastry chef. He's also James Beard Award winner, and his book is called Dessert Foreplay. It's beautiful. You need to pick it up. We were talking in the context of molecular gastronomy, but it's more than just in the context of molecular gastronomy. One of the great things that you really deal with in your book, first of all, one of the things I love about your book is if you want to buy it and put it on the coffee table, and you can just do that. It's a beautiful book to read. It's visually a beautiful book. It's got a lot of weight and heft to it, and the pictures are unique, and the food itself looks great. But if you want to actually cook from it, I think it's a very accessible book to cook from, and you're going to get a result that really doesn't look. It's very Johnny Uzzini desserts. It's not a kind of classic dessert style. And I think with desserts, especially like this, you must have a picture to see what it looks like in the end. You can't describe to somebody in words, you know, what these things are about. So I love the book from a number of perspectives. You put out at Jean-Georges desserts. You call it foreplay because you put out little quartets of dessert, the four little tasting desserts. Within each dessert, though, or in the little flight of four, one of the things that you have a tremendous variety of always is texture. I mean, you have everything from tuiles to gelées to you call liquid gels to sodas. Talk to us about texture. I think that's super important in desserts.
Yeah, I mean, so much of what we do is based around, you know, we talk about the four plays, and four plays always have a single theme, whether it's a single ingredient like strawberry or cherry, or maybe a season like spring or autumn, or, you know, something like chocolate or caramel. You know, and what we do is we focus on presenting that individual ingredient or that theme in a way that each dessert shows how diverse it could possibly be. So we're talking about strawberries. You know, we might serve a beautiful clarified strawberry juice that we then carbonate in-house. You know, so you have a sparkling, essentially strawberry water. It's delicious. Or we make a beautiful, you know, very sharp strawberry sorbet or an ice cream. Or then we could take the same strawberries, you know, we get these beautiful tri-star strawberries and roast them and do like a really just a fresh shortcake a la minute. But then I could get technical and I could, you know, turn it in, you know, puree it and add maybe a hydrochloride and then spread it out and then do a fruit leather, you know, or a tuile or something like that, you know, where it's just like, again, just for me, going back to like the macaroni and cheese thing, like I like to see how many dimensions I can get out of something and still present it in a beautiful and an absolutely delicious way, you know. And some things really lend themselves to different applications, whether it's through heat or cold, you know, or drying it or baking it. I mean, it's endless the possibilities of what you can do with ingredients. You know, it's just a matter of your imagination and your creativity.
All right. Final thing I want to talk about before I ask you for a recipe that we can talk to our guests about is you mentioned tri-star strawberries, local strawberries, classic example. I see a lot of strawberries as kind of a throwaway ingredient, big California Driscoll strawberries that are, you know, big and pretty and taste like
watery and cardboardy.
Watery and cardboardy and are white in the middle.
And kind of gross.
But tri-star strawberries and other local seasonal strawberries, when they're in season for that short period of time that they're in at the end of spring, beginning of summer, they're very strawberry-y as opposed to sweet. And, we go crazy about them. And it's actually, for us, it's marketing in a way, but it's very honest marketing when, you know, the first asparagus of the season just became available. We sent an email about it, and we did truffles and asparagus, you know, on our tasting menu for that week. And it brings people in because it's helping people to mark the passage of time and the change of seasons the way human beings have done for a long, long time. And I think that's awesome. You, I think a lot of people miss that in desserts. How do you deal with seasonality in your book? Talk to us about seasonality and desserts and what you should be doing in different seasons.
I mean, the book directly reflects how we cook at the restaurant. You know, we're very market-driven. We have relationships with all of our farmers up in upstate New York and Pennsylvania and New Jersey. I mean, we get product from everywhere, as local as we can. You know, starting now, like right now, I go to the market every Wednesday at Union Square, and we go on Saturday as well, and, you know, we have, you know, like that. The farmers call me like, okay, we just got the first flowers on the strawberry plants. You know, you're about this amount of time out. So give me time to prepare. you know, but it's difficult too because you're working within the restraints of nature, you know. So, you know, your menu is almost dictated by what you can get, you know. With like, I would never do a strawberry tasting with a California strawberry, so I have to wait until, you know, I have to wait until the New York, upstate New York, you know, TriStar strawberry start. But then, when we get a flood, then I'm in trouble, you know, because you know, all the strawberries are planted on these riverbanks. So then, as soon as it gets a lot of rain, whatever else, it washes them out, and then I get no strawberries for the menu, you know. So it can definitely be challenging, but there's something to be said about, you know, I grew up in the Catskills, so I get to visit these, you know, these farmers every time I go upstate and visit my family and stuff, and it's just amazing, you know. It's amazing what they do, and amazing to use product that comes from so close to the restaurant, you know. And yeah, when you have a delicious strawberry, when you have a fruit that's at its perfect ripeness, there's no other, you know. John George once said to me, and I'll never forget, that John George once said to me that, you know, there's no such thing as a bad fruit. There's only unripe fruit. And I've been telling my cooks that for 8 years. You know, it's such a great philosophy, you know. Like, pick fruit, use fruit at its ripest. Same thing for vegetables. You know, don't overpick stuff. Don't underpick stuff. And, you know, if you respect the fruit and you use it, you know, it's just beautiful. You know, you really don't have to do a whole lot to it. And strawberries are one of those things that, you know, I almost hate to manipulate them, but I try to do it in such a gentle way that I never lose their, you know, what's so special about them, their natural acidity and their structure and their sweetness and their profile, essentially. And it's just great products, you know. I love really great products.
Well, and I think that it's just a different way of being in the rhythm of life. If, you know, you wait for, you know, you get excited about strawberries, you know, once a year or twice a year, and that's the way it should be.
And you get them for a few weeks, and you're a little bit sad to see them go.
Go, exactly.
I think that the TriStars is a longer season than you think. You know, they're going to start up pretty soon. And last year, they went all the way into October.
TriStars go a little longer. We do a lot of early glows down here.
You got the early glow. Yeah, I know that variety.
We do a lot with there's a farm in Monroe called Indike Farms where we get a lot of our stuff from, and we put a lot of fruit up in the summertime for use later on. So what's funny is with us, we are into preserving. We preserve vegetables. Just we put them up, we can them, but we preserve most of our fruits in liquor, and it's really.
I want to come visit you guys. I want to see how this you guys roll this out. That sounds awesome.
Anytime, ride your motorcycle. I'll come
Absolutely.
And get you. We'll ride motorcycles around down in Jersey. It's actually some
Monroe?
Decent places. The farm is in Monroe Township. We're in New Brunswick.
Okay.
But we'll see you around New York, I'm sure. I want to.
Johnny, I know you're going to be perfect behind a bar, man. That's I can't believe they've kept you cooped up in a kitchen all this time. For anybody who's never met Johnny, he's just a personality. He's a force of nature, and you're going to be awesome out front. The one thing I'm going to say is the thing you've been brilliant about. Wait for the right deal, man.
Yeah.
Right for the right deal. Wait for the right partnership. And that way you can do it and do it in a way that you can keep doing it.
And we have some big news coming up. You know, they haven't released it, so I can't really talk about it. All I'm gonna say is wait till mid September, and you're gonna be seeing me a lot more often.
Extraordinary. Just remember, Francis and Mark get invited to the opening party. Johnny, thanks for coming on the show. Buy Johnny's book. It's called Dessert Foreplay, Sweet Quartets from a 4-Star Pastry Chef. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of the Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to RestaurantGuysRadio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis. Johnny Uzzini, I cannot tell you how great a pastry book this is. It's super exciting. And I talked to Johnny after on the commercial break, and he said we could put up a recipe. There's a recipe here for apple soup, sweet potato gnocchi. I think we're gonna.
That's gonna be the one.
I think that's the one.
That's gonna be the one.
I think that's the one we'll put up on the website.
Johnny's got a great balance between confidence and ego. You know, so many people in our business, as we go through, and Francis and I obviously know a lot of people, meet a lot of people, and you know, chefs in particular, bartenders too. You know, you can ego can get in the way of them being great, I think, sometimes. And what I really like about Johnny is he's confident, but he's not egotistical. He walks that line very, very well.
Well, and we need to point out that he achieved a lot of what he achieved very,
very
young.
Very
exactly.
young. That, and that's, I guess that's what I mean. You know, yeah. Obviously he's very accomplished and he's really good at what he does, but it's not at the expense of being egotistical. And I guess that for the young chefs out there and entrepreneurs and restaurant owners and bartenders, I guess that's the message here. You can be confident. I mean, you listen to Johnny talk. He's confident about the things he knows and the things he does, but it's not egotistical.
Well, and he's always a very curious fellow. You know, he really likes to listen and expand his own knowledge. And I'll tell you, he went through some trial by fire in that he was the only American guy in Danielle's kitchen for a while. And, you know, that's a tough place to be. And like, you know what I really like about the conversation we just had? One of the things he said that I sort of knew because we have some mutual friends. I don't know Johnny that well, and neither you, but we have some mutual friends who think a lot of him and have spoken very well of him for a long time to us. He said, you know, I'm a very loyal guy. I've been with Jean-Georges for 7 years. I was with Danielle for 7 years before that. And you know what? As in this business, I think that's great. But as a human being, I think that's becoming a lost. It's a lost attribute. Not a lot of people have that attribute anymore, and it's something that Mark, you and I have valued forever. We've been friends for 20 how many years? 25?
Absolutely.
27 years.
Sometimes people look at their restaurant experience. They look at the restaurants they've been in, and it's almost like notches on their belt. It's almost like that's I was there, and that's not always a good thing. Sometimes, you know, in the first place he worked for Danielle, he worked under three different pastry chefs over a period of time. And what he says is, you know, that gave me the opportunity to work almost like be in three different restaurants because I got to do that. But at the same time, continue working for Danielle and continue working with the philosophy and in the type of place I wanted to be in.
Well, and you know, I'll tell you that I think that one of the things about our business that I find most fulfilling is the relationships that you form with people who care about food and wine and have that particular passion. We had some folks. We had a wonderful evening a few weeks back. Two ex-employees who are now dating each other, who worked for us a while, had come in on the same night that there were three couples of ex-employees who all came in together and had dinner at the restaurant, and they were coming in to see us. And these are people who still remain personally loyal to you and me and we to them. I mean, I celebrate every success that these guys have. And it was just super sweet to see them in the restaurant. I mean, they left our employ, five years ago?
Some of them as many as 7 and 8 years ago.
And had worked for us for, you know, 3, 4, 5 years prior to that. It's a very positive thing in this business. What I like about the food business is there's still an opportunity to have a very human interaction. And I'm not knocking anybody who works for a large corporation. Lots of large corporations provide great work environments. But there's something different about working for small businesses and working in this business that's the somewhere between manufacturing, retailing, and art.
You left out one other thing it's between.
What's that?
Ridiculousness.
It's really crazy. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed this last crazy hour with the Restaurant Guys. I know that we certainly have. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and restaurantguysradio.com.